I next met with Dr. Stephen Gore, and to begin, he commented on what's new in MDS.
One of the interesting things is a glimmer of new information from a trial that I'm actually PI on from the U.S. Leukemia Intergroup through ECOG. This is E1905. It's a randomized phase 2 trial, and it was designed in some ways to look at two questions. The primary question that I think everyone is most interested in was whether the addition of a histone deacetylase inhibitor, in this case entinostat, would positively impact the outcome of a DNA methyltransferase inhibitor, in this case azacitidine. As many people know, this has been a sort of cottage industry combining these two classes of drugs over the past 10 years based on the biological observation that if you've got heavily methylated genes, the best way to turn them on in terms of gene expression is to give an azanucleoside followed by a histone deacetylase inhibitor. So ECOG 1905 was a randomized phase 2 study to look at azacitidine with and without entinostat, but the regimen that we had built in our phase 1 studies included a 10-day schedule of azacitidine at 50 milligrams per meter squared per day, rather than the usual 75 times 7. Now, you may say, well, if you multiply that out, they're really pretty dose comparable in terms of total dose. But when we think of how drugs like azacitidine and deoxyazacitidine work, we think they're getting incorporated into DNA and then having the cell replicate with the azanucleoside in the DNA. So there's a theoretical advantage to giving low doses of the drug for longer periods of time. So we had built this combination therapy based on our 50 times 10 schedule of AZA, which has really never been tested in a large phase 2 setting. So we felt that it was important that our control arm in this randomized phase 2 trial actually be considered an experimental arm since it wasn't really a standard dose schedule of azacitidine. So in each case, as a randomized phase 2 trial, the arm A or arm B in this case are compared to historical controls, which were, for the most part, the Lou Silverman study, CALGB9221, which got azacitidine approved for the treatment of MDS. And our subjects included MDS, hematologically needy MDS, chronic myelomonocytic leukemia, and AML with trilineage dysplasia with low white count, what used to be called RABE-T and related diseases. The major endpoint was to try to double the rate of trilineage normalization. So that means complete remissions, partial remissions, and hematologic improvement in which all three lines of counts are within acceptable ranges. So real hematologic normalization, which in the CALGB9221 is about 15%. So we were looking for 30% rate of that combined endpoint. And it turns out that the combination arm, AZA plus entinostat, unfortunately did not make that mark. Statistically, it's within range. It was 24%, and given the number of patients, it certainly is consistent with 30%. But the AZA only at 50 times 10 did meet that mark. It was 30% trilineage normalization. The reason I think this is an important finding is because if this is validated, it really does support the theory that lower doses of AZA given for longer periods of time are more effective. And while this may not improve overall response rate or may not improve survival, we don't know, it potentially increased the number of people whose counts are substantially normalized. So that's something I think that, again, not to toot my own horn, but I think is potentially a very important and potentially in the future practice-changing observation.
Well, you know, in a way, it ties into the one thing I really wanted to ask you about, because I was talking to your co-author, Dr. Garcia Manero, about the paper you were involved with at ASH looking at oral 5-azacitidine. And I was starting to think about, well, you know, maybe if you could give it orally, you could almost give it chronically, you know, sort of following along the same idea.
Absolutely. And of course, that's the other horn that I was going to toot from ASH. You know, this is a phase 1 trial. And initially, we dose escalated on a daily times 7 schedule, just like sub-Q azacitidine, and found that it was tolerable up to a point. And we certainly had responses. And we could show that there were changes in DNA methylation comparable, at least qualitatively, to that with the parenteral azacitidine. But we found that in terms of pharmacokinetics, we could only get about probably at best 30% of the AUC that you get with a subcutaneous schedule. Now, that may not be bad because the subcutaneous schedule was picked out of the hat in the mid-80s. It was never scientifically derived. But anyway, we went about as far as we could go with the daily times 7 schedule. We then went ahead and explored daily times 14 and daily times 21 scheduling on both the QD and BID dosing schedule. And we found dose schedules on both of those schedules, as I'm sure you've heard from Dr. Garcia Manero, which are tolerable. We also found out doses which are not so tolerable because of GI side effects. And, you know, we have some very impressive responses, that's all I can say, in the daily times 14 and daily times 21.
Is that a thought that maybe somehow through using, you know, a more practical approach to this with an oral, that you could completely change the strategy and give, you know, much longer term treatment, or not really?
You know, I think that clinically giving people breaks pays off. You know, the toxicity of azacitidine and deoxyazacitidine, for that matter, are relatively mild compared to the conventional cytotoxic therapies that we're used to. But I do think that they are significant enough that people notice it when they're off it. So I think giving people breaks is useful.
What do you think it is? Fatigue, or what kinds of symptoms, you know, get better?
I think it's certainly a little bit of fatigue that's chronic. And again, people adapt to, but then when you're off it, it's like, wow, I forgot I wasn't really feeling normal. A lot of people get constipated, whether that's because of the 5-HT3 antagonist they're using to prevent nausea, or whether it's the azacitidine itself, that can be a problem as well.
So in terms of HDAC inhibitors, for example, combined with hypomethylating agents, is that, you know, sort of a dead issue, or do you think it just needs to be explored a different way?
Yeah, no, I hope that our study won't be taken as the final answer by any means. Obviously, we were working with a particular agent and a particular dose schedule of that agent. In our schedule, patients get 10 days of AZA with the HDAC inhibitor given on days 3 and 10. In vitro, you need prior exposure to the DNA methyltransferase inhibitor before the HDAC inhibitor in order to get synergistic gene re-expression. But HDAC inhibitors are cell cycle antagonists. So there's a concern that even coming in on day 3, you may shoot yourself in the foot by not letting enough of the AZA nucleoside get in if the cells aren't cycling. So we are actually about to embark on another randomized phase 2 trial at Hopkins and a couple of other centers, Cornell and Northwestern, which will examine the same schedule that we have, the overlapping schedule, versus a totally sequential administration, that is 10 days of AZA followed by 2 doses of entinostat. So that's one approach to try to augment what we hope we might be seeing. Then, of course, there are other agents. And I'd say of the combinations, the one which is most promising right now is the combination of AZA plus vorinostat, which Lou Silverman at Mount Sinai has been piloting. And his preliminary data from his phase 1 study, I think, you know, have some knock-your-socks-off kinds of response rates, like 75 and 80%. But it's a small multi-institution phase 1 trial, so we know how that goes.
Can you explain what we know right now? I've seen work that you've done looking at this question of epigenetic methylation and its correlation with different cytogenetic abnormalities in MDS.
Well, I don't think we know that methylation and any particular cytogenetic category track, but we do know that MDS has one of the more heavily methylated genomes or epigenomes of any hematologic malignancy, certainly, and among the most methylated of all cancers. That said, we do not yet have a methylation signature which we know to predict response to a DNA methyltransferase inhibitor. We don't know any specific genes whose methylation or whose reversal of methylation really reliably tracks with clinical response. So either we haven't found the right signature, or perhaps our idea of mechanism isn't entirely correct, and I don't think we know which of those it is yet.
Yeah, actually, I'm looking at a poster from the last ASCO meeting. I had your name on it, gene methylation and cytogenetic abnormalities in patients with high-risk MDS. So I didn't understand it, but that was where I saw it.
I think the observation is that azacitidine and probably deoxyazacitidine work as well in patients with traditionally poor-risk karyotypes, including monosomy 7 and complex karyotypes, as they do in people with better risk cytogenetic abnormalities. So negative cytogenetics or high risk cytogenetics does not seem to be an adverse prognostic factor for the response to these agents, which is very important to remember, especially because, you know, our knee-jerk paradigm, especially for people with more advanced disease, including AML, is to slap them on cytarabine-based chemotherapy, which routinely doesn't work. So one of the things that I'm interested in pursuing in the future is potentially actually examining in a randomized fashion in AML with bad risk cytogenetics, going with a standard cytarabine-based therapy versus a DNA methyltransferase inhibitor.
Just to kind of maybe continue on with this issue of duration of treatment with hypomethylating agents, because we get a lot of questions from oncologists. What do I do with the patient who's doing well after a year, you know, getting kind of cranky about coming into the office? And I wanted to ask you about another paper that you were involved with that I guess, actually, I just saw the EPUB. I don't think it's actually come out in Cancer. Continued azacitidine therapy beyond time of first response improves quality of response. What's this paper looking at and what's it mean?
This is data from the AZA-001 study, which was a survival trial run primarily in Europe of AZA versus three conventional care regimens. That would be supportive care, low-dose cytarabine, and intensive cytarabine-based leukemia-style, AML-style induction chemotherapy. Those three comparators were lumped together as a, you know, it was a physician's choice kind of thing, and they were a combined comparator. And this analysis, with the PI being Lou Silverman, again, looks at the time to first response and best response and shows that it may take as long as 12 months to see your first hematologic response, and responses do continue to improve. It has been a bugaboo for clinicians and patients in terms of how long to continue these agents, as you've suggested. And the biggest problem is the people who have been treated for about 6 months, six cycles, and are still very transfusion dependent. They're no worse, but they're no better. And what do you do with them? And, you know, I don't think we have the answer to that, but we have presented, again, at ASCO this year, a multivariate analysis of the AZA-001 data, which looked at the issue of survival benefit and looked at hematologic responses at various time points, 3, 6, and 9 cycles. So if at any point you have a hematologic improvement or better on azacitidine, your survival is better than the patients in the comparator arm who had that response. That is that people who have HI, PR, or CR with azacitidine survive longer than the group that gets HI, PR, or CR in the comparator group. Now, that said, what happens to people whose best response is stable disease? This is data that we are still very much analyzing, and what it shows is that if your best response is stable disease at 6 months, in either arm, you have a survival advantage compared to people who don't get stable disease. And perhaps that's not really surprising. The problem is you can't really show that the people who are stable on AZA are surviving longer than the people who are stable on conventional care at 6 months. But there's some suggestion that the people who were stable on AZA, their baseline characteristics were worse. So in a very inferential way, you can argue that, well, they're worse patients and they're stable, so maybe they are benefiting. And I think that it's certainly not the hardest level, strongest level of evidence, and I think it's an open question. That said, how long to keep such patients on? For patients who you think are having a potential survival advantage, and of course the survival advantage applies to people with high-risk disease, it's not been demonstrated in low-risk disease, the current recommendation remains to continue them on as long as they're responding and are tolerating the drug. And that was supported by a study that a colleague of mine, Thomas Prébé, who's from Marseille, presented at ASH this year, which looked at the outcomes of people who have either failed to respond to azacitidine or responded and then ceased to respond. And he looked at data from the AZA-001 study, data from Johns Hopkins, and data from the French Groupe Francophone du Myelodysplasie. And it's quite a large study, and it shows that people who stop responding or don't respond to azacitidine really have a very limited life expectancy. Anyway, so it seems that the longer you stay on it, probably the better off you are, unless you're going to go off for transplant or something like that.
What about the use of IMIDs, specifically lenalidomide and MDS? Anything new? I know there was some stuff that came out in ASH on that.
Right. So there's not a lot new in terms of monotherapy in low-risk disease. There is interest in looking at higher doses. And when I'm talking about higher, we're talking about 50 milligrams per day compared to the usual 10 or 5. And certainly there's some glimmer that even in AML, there are some complete responses to high-dose lenalidomide. But again, how frequent that is and who the patients are, I think remains to be seen. I think the most interesting stuff with lenalidomide right now in MDS is the combination of azacitidine plus IMIDs. developed by Mikhail Sekaris at Cleveland Clinic. Again, it's mostly phase one data. There is a phase two extension to his study, similar to the AZA vorinostat study that I mentioned before. The responses that are coming out of the phase one data are kind of knock your socks off responses. So I think more to be seen there. There is a proposal to do an intergroup study that will include that as one of the arms.
Fascinating. So what about AML? Anything new there? And particularly, we're constantly getting questions from docs in practice about the older patients.
I don't think that there is a lot that's really very exciting in AML. What I would say is kind of the biggest surprise to me was data presented by Jeff Lancet at ASH on CPX-351, I want to say, but that may not be right. Anyway, it's a liposomal formulation of combined cytarabine and daunorubicin. And I have to tell you, when I first heard about this drug, I just had very little confidence about it. The science is predicated upon maintaining a 5-to-1 ratio, molar ratio of these two agents, which the company feels is optimal for killing cells. And, you know, that's a whole other thing we can talk about, whether that's a valid premise or not. The delivery of the drugs through the liposomal formulation looks quite good, whether it's really selective to leukemic cells or not. Again, I think that's the push. But the fascinating thing was that there was a couple of studies. One was a relapse study randomizing patients to this CPX versus either high-dose ARC or mitoxantrone, cytarabine, and VP16, so-called MEC. And the other was, I believe, an upfront study in some high-risk and elderly AMLs, you know, against a standard 3 and 7. And what was really amazing is that overall, I think the study is a bust. I don't think there's any advantage. But in the subset of patients who have a demonstrated history of myelodysplastic syndrome, marked survival advantage, marked, again, knock your socks off kind of data. Now, whether that's because the drug formulated like this is better in those patients, whether it's more tolerable, it certainly seems like it probably is more tolerable, less mucositis to give to the elderly. So I think there's a real, probably very important signal there if that's reproduced. So I think that's very exciting.
How do you approach the 80, 85-year-old in your own practice?
Well, at Hopkins, we're very interested in studying these patients with new agents and in new approaches. And so whenever possible, we try to have tolerable clinical trials available for them. Currently, unfortunately, we do not. So I think such patients need to be counseled appropriately about the seriousness of their disease and the unlikeliness of a meaningful remission with quality of life if they get conventional therapy. So I'll treat many of those patients with supportive care with hydroxyurea. I will give some of those patients a shot at a DNA methyltransferase inhibitor like azacitidine or deoxyaza, especially if they're, you know, low counters. I think they're very appropriate for that kind of therapy. The high counters, probably not so much. And I think a frank discussion about supportive care, palliative care, hospice care is not out of line with those patients.
What's your current approach right now to the younger patients? What kind of trials are open to them, and how do you manage them in a non-protocol setting?
So younger patients obviously need to be treated aggressively, and I think that the current direction has to be at molecular understanding of the leukemia, the best possible characterization of FLT3 mutational analysis, obviously cytogenetic analysis, and NPM1 mutations, all these new mutations that are coming out that are very important prognostically. I think, you know, off protocol, there's not compelling data to use one kind of induction regimen over another. You know, I come from a school where cytarabine intensive therapies based either on dose and or timing are preferred. That said, there's very little randomized data to support that notion. So I think that as long as one is giving an adequate therapy, and I think if one is giving 3 and 7, the current standard of care is 90 per meter squared of daunorubicin from the data from the E1900 study, as opposed to 45 per meter squared. So anyway, you know, you need to get them into remission, and then you need to stratify or tailor the therapy based on the molecular subgroup that they're in. And, you know, frankly, these days, outside of the patients with very good risk leukemias like core binding factor leukemias, my default is more and more to consider early transplant for many of these patients.
How do you utilize these markers, and which ones do you consider essential, say, in community practice?
Right. So obviously we need to know about the core binding factor leukemias. That's translocation A21 and inversion 16. Those data are usually available from conventional cytogenetics. And those patients, I think most of us would believe, should be treated with conventional cytarabine-based chemotherapy, including a high dose of cytarabine in consolidation. The potential exception there is that there is a subset that has mutations of c-KIT, and they do much less well. And that test is not readily clinically available, although I know you can get it from the Mayo Clinic. We have a hard time getting it ourselves. But those who have c-KIT mutation should be considered for alternative therapies. What people are most interested in is including a BCR-ABLE tyrosine kinase inhibitor like dasatinib or nilotinib, which seem to have activity against mutated c-KIT. But that's totally untested. There's going to be a CALGB-based trial that's going to examine that. So I think that's the first place to start. The next place is primarily for the normal karyotype AMLs is FLT3 mutational analysis. That is readily available clinically. And we know that the FLT3 mutated leukemias do not stay in remission very long. And the only good outcomes that we've seen are with the fastest transplant possible when they're in remission. So that's what we're trying to do there. And again, I think it's something that can be applied to community practice.
What about specific agents used in terms of these FLT3 positive tumors? I've heard sorafenib is one.
Right. So there are FLT3 kinase inhibitors that are clinically active, and sorafenib is the one that's FDA approved. How you use them remains really a very uncertain area. And I defer to the expertise of my colleague at Hopkins, Mark Levis, who's certainly a world leader in the field of FLT3 mutated AML. And while sorafenib can be used to get relapsed patients into a transplantable state, he does not advocate the use of sorafenib up front, except in the case where transplant is forthcoming and you need another week or two to bridge the patient, sorafenib may be able to hold them in check. So we're not really recommending sorafenib use outside of a clinical trial in general.
I didn't ask you before when you were talking about MDS, how are you generally approaching patients with MDS? Obviously, it's very individualized based on the patient, but can you sort of paint a general picture and algorithm about how you manage these people?
Sure. So I think there's short-term issues for MDS patients and there's long-term issues for MDS patients. So the first thing I always ask is this patient now or could this patient ever be a candidate for a potentially curable allogeneic stem cell transplant? Because I think that always needs to be kept in mind. And of course, now we do non-ablative transplants up through age 75. So it's not a trivial question, really. That's not to say that every 75-year-old should get a transplant, but it could be considered in appropriate patients up through that age. That said, I do use both the International Prognostic Scoring System and the newer WPSS system, which is based on the WHO classification. And I'm using the WPSS system more and more because it recognizes the importance of transfusion dependence in predicting survival as well. So there are many patients who on IPSS are lower risk, but when you factor in a couple of issues in the WPSS, first of all, if they have refractory cytopenias with multilineage dysplasia, so-called RCMD, which wasn't a diagnosis back in the IPSS days, that pushes people into a higher risk group. People who are getting transfusions get pushed into a higher risk group. So I think that it's a useful prognostic scoring system to use. And then the higher risk patients should go on an azanucleoside analog, and the only one which has been proved to improve survival is azacitidine. So I think that azacitidine is the treatment of choice off of a clinical trial for those patients with higher risk disease, with consideration of will I take this patient to transplant, and if so, when, for potential cure. Now, with the lower risk patients, you know, I think things are complicated. So what are their hematologic needs? Is their primary problem transfusion dependence? Is their primary problem just kind of low-grade anemia that's causing them symptoms? Are they thrombocytopenic? Is their problem chronic neutropenia, et cetera? The neutropenia turned out that most patients really can tolerate, and I don't think that there's necessarily anything to be done, need be done, for the patient who is chronically neutropenic who is not having recurrent infections. But for the anemia, which is usually the main problem that's causing people symptoms, one looks at the endogenous erythropoietin level, serum erythropoietin level, and if it's less than 500, then a good trial of erythropoietic stimulating agents with or without G-CSF is indicated. If the EPO level is not low, or if they fail to respond to a good 12-week trial of adequately dosed ESAs, then one needs to go to the next step. There is a group of patients who clearly responds to immunosuppressive therapy. That said, I don't know who those patients are, so it's hard to recommend that approach.
Immunosuppressive therapy with what?
Well, the classic one is antithymocyte globulin, but the patients who respond to antithymocyte globulin probably also respond to cyclosporine A. which is a lot easier to give. So the patients in whom I consider that are patients who have hypocellular disease on their biopsy, although the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute data does not support hypocellularity as being a criterion for response to immunosuppressive therapy. Most of the other trials do. So in people who are hypocellular or who have other sort of kind of immune-ish phenotypes like a presence of an LGL population, a large granular lymphocyte population, are the patients in whom I'll consider a trial of cyclosporin A, which is usually what I try first. And then there's the question of lenalidomide. Certainly patients who have failed to respond to erythropoietic stimulating agents or who are not candidates for ESAs and who have deletion of chromosome 5q in the appropriate region, band 31.1, I think lenalidomide is the treatment of choice. I think for patients who don't have that abnormality, lenalidomide can be considered if they are not thrombocytopenic. And for the rest of the patients, if they're symptomatically anemic, then I think AZA or deoxyazacitidine either way are appropriate. But that said, you know, you're kind of spending a trump card when you give those treatments.
Anything else in terms of AML and MDS that we haven't talked about you want to comment on, questions you get from docs in practice?
Yeah, I was going to say the other another approach for elderly patients, again, I'm not sure about the 80-year-old you're talking about so much, but the elderly patient with AML, many of them can be palliated with low-dose clofarabine, which was promulgated by Alan Burnett from the UK, and we've had some good success in that. It's quite expensive therapy, and you have to get insurance to cover it, and it's not without toxicity by any means. But it can be delivered as an outpatient. So I think for your 70 to whatever year old AMLs that you don't have a clinical trial for and for whom azacitidine may not seem appropriate or who have failed to respond to azacitidine, low-dose clofarabine is a decent option.
Let's talk a little bit about APL. Anything that's come out over the last 6 months or a year that you think docs in practice need to know about?
So in the past year, the main event in APL was the publication of CLGB 9710, which was a trial randomly assigning patients with APL to getting two cycles of arsenic trioxide in remission or not. And survival is markedly improved in the patients receiving arsenic trioxide. And this was a bit of a surprise to me because I didn't think that arsenic was going to be so active to be able to improve survival over what was already a pretty decent survival rate given the amount of therapy that was included in the C9710 study. Now, C9710 has been criticized because the control arm did not do as well as one would like based on what people think people should respond and based on the European studies, especially the Spanish Patema group, which is to say that the survival in the control arm was only about 60%. That said, it was a well-done randomized clinical trial in the U.S. Leukemia Intergroup, so I think those data are real data, and I think it definitely shows the importance of arsenic. Now, the really cool thing is that the arsenic trioxide seems to overcome the negative impact of having high-risk APL based on white count. So if you compare the outcomes of patients with high-risk APL on C9710 who got arsenic, their outcomes are just like, once they're in remission, their outcomes are just like the patients with low-risk APL. There are essentially almost no relapses in patients who survive APL and receive arsenic-based therapy. The other piece of evidence which supports that is a study that I published from a small multicenter trial with about 40 patients where APL patients induced into remission with all transretinoic acid and daunorubicin received only one cycle of arsenic-based consolidation. They received 3 days of cytarabine, 3 days of daunorubicin in remission, and then 30 doses of arsenic starting on day 8. And then the high-risk patients also got some maintenance for 2 years. But our outcomes, again, is a very small study. We had only one relapse in the patients who were so consolidated, which suggests that even the C9710 approach may be way over-treating these patients. So I think that if we're up to me, we'd be looking at ways of using arsenic to minimize the amount of toxic therapy we're giving to these patients, I think, unnecessarily.
So what does that mean in terms of the way you approach patients right now outside of protocol setting?
Well, we continue to follow our paradigm, which was published in JCO either last year or the year before, with our ATRA daunorubicin induction followed by the arsenic-based consolidation therapy. That said, if I weren't doing that, I would probably follow either the C9710 arsenic arm or one can follow one of the regimens using arsenic in remission induction along with ATRA. That would include the Shanghai study as well as the MD Anderson study, whose first author is Ravandi.
What about just the use of ATRA and arsenic without anything else?
Yeah, so that approach is the MD Anderson approach. You don't find a lot of patients in their study. Well, you have some, but there are a lot of patients in the study also got some cytotoxic therapy along the way during induction. That was kind of investigator's choice to go ahead and give idarubicin or gemtuzumab. So, and that said, I would have to say that their relapses look a little more frequent than the other studies. Statistically, you know, you can't say anything about it. They're all phase two studies. But I have a feeling that in that case, for some patients, it's being pushed a little too far. From that point of view, there's also a study from India that's arsenic only. They did this, you know, in a country with very little means, and basically patients got only arsenic, and certainly about half the patients are cured. But, you know, I think our goal should really be to cure as many patients as possible and not have to try to salvage patients. So I think some anthracycline is probably important.
Anything new in terms of the biology of the disease or what we know about how some of these agents work?
You know, there's some very fascinating studies by a French guy named Hugues Dette. Hugues spelled something like Hugh, H-U-G-H-E-S, Hugues Dette, which look at the mechanisms of arsenic toxicity. And it looks like the only way to kill APL stem cells is with arsenic. So there does seem to be some very important selective toxicity of arsenic on the APL malignant stem cell. And I think that that probably tells us, at least to some extent, why the addition of arsenic is so powerful in curing these patients.
What kinds of toxicity issues have you run into with arsenic?
Well, you know, obviously QT prolongation is pretty routine. In our trial, we allowed the QTC to ride out as far as it wanted to ride out, making sure that we kept the serum potassium greater than 4 and the magnesium greater than 2, as long as patients weren't having dysrhythmias. We, in fact, had no patients with dysrhythmias, and we had patients with a QTC in the 580 millisecond range. One patient was convinced by his cardiologist and another by the cardiology department in another hospital, one of our other centers that participated in the trial. They did not feel that it was safe to do so, and that patient chose to come off study. And I think that patient was the single patient that relapsed, if I'm not mistaken. So that's really the main problem. Otherwise, the arsenic is totally well tolerated. It's not very convenient right now because you need to come in, you know, 5 days a week and get infusions. There are data from Hong Kong that the drug is orally bioavailable. And of course, the drug was available, you know, historically through Fowler's solution orally, which is basically arsenic. So I'm hoping that the U.S. companies get on that bandwagon and study oral arsenic, because that would clearly change the face of APL for everybody, I think.
Anything that we haven't talked about today that you want to bring up?
Well, I think that while it's not particularly new news, the appropriate ways to give erythropoietic stimulating agents, I think, remains a real problem, which is that many, I would say, practicing oncologists are used to the 40,000 units a week of EPO that they've given, you know, for breast cancer and for chemotherapy and things like that, which in general is not an adequate dose for MDS patients. So for MDS patients, as I've mentioned before, an EPO level really needs to be determined up front. If it's greater than 500, they're never going to respond. As a matter of fact, if you look at the ECOG study, E1996, the bottom line is that the median, although patients were stratified or selected based on their EPO level, the actual median serum EPO level of the responders was 40. You know, it's well below the 200 or 500. So anyway, the bottom line is people need to have their EPO level assessed, and people over 500 probably shouldn't be started. And that said, most, you know, healthy-sized individuals will require the equivalent of 80 or 90,000 units of erythropoietin per week, or 300 micrograms of darbepoetin per week. And these are much higher doses than people are using. My wife and I, her name is Amy Davidoff, she's a health economist, are currently engaged in a project using the Serum Medicare database to look at ESA use in MDS patients nationally in the Medicare population. And it's pretty clear that if patients haven't had a response to an ESA, that is in terms of, these are transfusion-dependent patients. So if they haven't developed transfusion independence within 12 weeks or so of ESA use, they never become transfusion independent. So that's the other thing, is that I think physicians tend to fool themselves that the ESAs are doing anything, and they're not after a while.
Were you able to determine what doses are being used?
You know, we can't get that data from that database. You can sort of infer numbers of vials that are dispensed, but it's administrative data that you really can't get. You can't drill down on it. That would be very interesting to know.